From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we review some of the trends that emerged in 1987 in the film industry. I speak with Algene Harmetz, who covers Hollywood for the New York Times. Also today, I talk with poet and essayist Tess Gallagher. She has a new book titled Amplitude, New and Selected Poems. It ranges from early poems about her father working in the mills to new poems about her lover, writer Raymond Carver. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews his 10 best list for 1987, and TV critic David Bianculli previews The Singing Detective, the BBC miniseries coming soon to many public television stations. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The end of the year is the time when most film critics are at work compiling their 10 best lists. When Algene Harmetz looks back on the year in film, she reviews the behind-the-scenes trends, the trends that made production of the best and worst films possible. Harmetz writes about Hollywood and the business of movies for the New York Times. She's based in Los Angeles, near the center of the industry. Harmetz got her start writing for the fan magazines like Modern Screen and Photoplay. She has also written two books, The Making of the Wizard of Oz and Rolling Breaks and Other Movie Business. I spoke with Algene Harmetz earlier today from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. I asked her first if 1987 was a good year at the box office.
It was a spectacular year at the box office in some ways. I think that the amount of money pouring into theater wickets is going to be over $4.2 billion. Hollywood's best year was $4.1 billion in 1984. But you have to step one step back and take a really good look at that. The theater owners are exuberant. They have had a great year. But there's been so much product in the marketplace. Two Hollywood movies are called product. There's been so much product that a lot of pictures have failed very quickly. And I'm not just talking about big budget bombs such as Ishtar and Bill Crosby's Christmas movie, Leonard the Sixth. Talking about a lot of fairly good little movies that were pulled by the theater owners because there were more to replace them. So if you really look at this Christmas season, the people who come out best are the exhibitors and Paramount and Disney, which presumably have three of the five biggest hits in the marketplace, Three Men and a Baby, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Cinderella.
So in other words, the movies that are doing well are doing very well and are drawing lots of people to the theaters, but a lot of the movies that don't do spectacularly well just get lost and put aside to accommodate something else that might be a big seller.
Well, to accommodate something else that has a chance of being a big seller, at least. There are 100 movies waiting to get into theaters, then the law of supply and demand says that the exhibitors are in the catbird seat. They're driving. If there are very few movies and lots of theaters, then it's the movie studios that are in the catbird seat.
Well, this might explain something that I've noticed, that sometimes a movie comes to town, and if I don't rush out and see it the weekend it opens, I'm going to miss it. A movie like Bestseller, which opened earlier this year. Now, I heard it wasn't the greatest movie, but I didn't have a chance to make up my mind. The movie came and went before I had a chance to get to the theater.
I liked Bestseller quite a bit. The two actors in it, James Woods and Brian Dennehy, are both wonderful, and to watch them maneuvering in this taut thriller was a great deal of fun for me, but you're absolutely right. If a movie doesn't succeed in its first week, then it's very likely not to be there after a couple of weeks. It used to be, as I've been told by the executives in charge of distribution, it used to be that you could always get a movie open. That is, if you spent enough money, you could always get a good opening weekend out of it in terms of audiences coming and sampling it, and you could always keep it around for 2 weeks. Now, if it doesn't work, you won't keep it around beyond a week. And there are some movies, a good example is The Princess Bride, which really required time to build. And so Fox was extremely nervous because of the propensity of the theater owners to yank movies that weren't doing extremely well.
Sure, it sounds like it's impossible. It sounds like it's impossible to be a sleeper now.
Pretty much so, yes. That is exactly what's happened.
I think perhaps the most successful film of the year has been Fatal Attraction. It not only has drawn in big crowds, but it's continuing to draw them after months and months in movie theaters. Did anyone in the industry expect that to be the big hit it turned out to be?
No. That's what makes the movies fun. You can never quite predict. I think that once the movie was tested, which is the common way of looking at movies nowadays, and once the ending was changed because audiences threw things at the screen in the test screenings with an original ending in which Glenn Close commits suicide, once that was done, I think Paramount was pretty well assured that they had a movie that would be a success at the box office, but no one can predict a blockbuster with two exceptions. You can predict a blockbuster, and a blockbuster is a movie that makes over about $100 million at the box office. You can predict one if it is a sequel to a successful movie. Everyone knew that Beverly Hills Cop 2 was going to be a blockbuster, and you can possibly predict one if you have one of the very rare stars like Eddie Murphy, who in a particular kind of movie is bound to be a major success.
I'm interested in this changed ending in Fatal Attraction. Now, I learned about this through one of your articles in the New York Times. Initially, Glenn Close was supposed to commit suicide by slitting her throat with a knife that had Michael Douglas's fingerprints on it. So she not only took her own life, she was basically condemning him to be sentenced to murder. And you'd said that audiences were so upset at this ending, they literally threw things at the screen. Now, why did the studio heads or whomever decide that they were going to test this ending and see what kind of reaction they got? And if they didn't like the reaction, they were just going to change the ending.
Well, movie directors have a certain amount of control, and this was the ending that the director, Adrian Lyne, liked. I mean, this was his ending. This was what he wanted. And he says still that he feels more sympathetic towards Glenn Close than audiences felt. That was one of the shocks for him. He kept his sympathy with her through the second act of the movie until she went out to their country house and started doing things like boiling rabbits. But audiences lost patience with her much, much earlier in the movie. That was something that Lyne did not expect.
But does this happen a lot, that a movie will be shown to get the audience reaction, and if the reaction is negative, that the ending will be changed?
It happens a lot that movies have research screenings to get audience reaction. Usually you try to make a research screening with the core audience of the movie. It's not very much use to you to take a movie about teenagers and invite an audience of 45-year-olds to see it and criticize it. So you go for screenings with the core audience. And now, recently, there has been a lot of changing the movies, not necessarily the ending, after the research screenings, but that's nothing new. It goes back to Irving Thalberg, the boy wonder of Hollywood, who was in charge of Universal in its early years and then the person behind MGM from 1924 till his death in 1936. Irving Thalberg said, "Movies are not made, they're remade." And at one point, in one of the, I think, Men and Bill, in a movie with Wallace Beery, he reshot an entire major sequence because Beery's shoes did not squeak when he was going down the aisle at, I think, a wedding. And so it wasn't funny. And when the movie actually came out with the squeaking shoes, it was very funny, and the movie was a box office success.
Well, who decides that there's going to be a research screening? Is it the studio head? Is it the director?
No, it's not the director. It's the studio.
Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about how a lot of movies come and go in the bat of an eye, and that there's no chance for audience reaction, word of mouth, to build. Another trend that I've noticed living in Philadelphia is that it takes weeks for movies to come here sometimes. You know, they'll open in New York or Los Angeles and maybe San Francisco, and sometimes we have to wait 6 weeks, 2 months before a movie comes here. I'm still waiting to see Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. Why is that pattern so erratic? At least it seems erratic to me.
Well, this is the way that you can protect a movie. It's basically been used by the distributors of small movies or the major distributors when they have an art movie, a movie that they need to get good reviews in New York and good reviews and good response in Los Angeles before they send it out to other cities. Then, like Sammy and Rosie, Room with a View, Morris, it will come with an imprimatur, essentially, a little tag that says, hey, this movie got great reviews in New York, and it's a fine little art film. It's the way that they used to handle foreign films.
I see. So it's actually in order to improve the word of mouth and the advertising and reviews.
Yes. Now, some of the studios use a modified platform for major movies. Disney used that with Tin Men. They opened in about, 50 theaters maybe, because they trusted the movie, they trusted the word of mouth, but they knew that if they opened it in 1,000 theaters at once, nobody would go, because the idea of the movie was so bizarre, a movie about aluminum siding salesman, and it didn't really have any major stars in it.
You know, it's amazing to me how office politics can affect the life or death of a movie. I've read, for instance, that The Last Emperor, the Bernardo Bertolucci movie, is not getting a lot of promotion because it's a former studio head who backed that movie, and now he's out, and his successor doesn't want to make this former studio head look good, so they don't care if the movie fails. I mean, is that true?
I don't think that's very true. I'm sure that there is some feelings, as there always is, that you want to see the guy whose job that you've taken fail, you want to prove how much better you are than whoever came before. But it would be really dopey for a studio to kill a expensive movie, even though they only had a certain limited amount of money in it, for reasons of revenge. I don't think they did it. I think it's a lot more complicated than that.
You mentioned earlier that this was a terrific year at the box office for the movies that were successful. And so it was very good for the theaters that showed the successful movies. Now, does the movie industry think that we are going to the movies with more regularity than we used to? I remember it seemed just a few years ago that there was a lot of panic in the movie industry, that people were staying home more, watching television and cable more, renting home video more frequently, and that this was taking a lot of the profits away from the theaters.
Well, actually, Art Murphy, who's the best financial analyst in the movie industry and has done it for Variety for years and years, keeps pointing out that the number of tickets sold over the last 20 years or so hasn't varied more than, maybe 10 million tickets a year. I mean, some not terribly large amount of ticket sales. The box office keeps going up because of ticket inflation, because the prices get higher. Certainly a few million more people went to the movies at some point during this year, but not enough more to change things. You can't say, yes, America's going back to the movies, and now it's going to be the way it was in 1940, when I believe 245 million people went to the movies every week. It's never going to be that way again because, of course, we have a lot of other entertainments fighting for the consumer's dollar. And we also have inside the home free television for a minimum charge. You have cable television for a little bit more money. You have home box office or Disney Channel, which will give you a lot of extra movies a month. You have video cassettes that in my neck of the woods, which is West Los Angeles, you can rent for a dollar a night. And you have baseball games and basketball games and football games. So it's never going to be that kind of halcyon world again.
My guest is Algene Harmetz, and she writes about the business of movie making for The New York Times. We're going to talk more about movies after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Algene Harmetz. She reports on the business of and the personalities behind the film industry. She reports for The New York Times. We've talked about some of the recent trends. Are there any other major trends that you think shaped up in 1987?
Oh, absolutely. And one of them we touched on, and you said that the exhibitors that were showing successful movies were making money. But all the exhibitors really are making money if they own multiplexes, and that's the big thing that's been happening in the movie industry today. I sort of use the catchword that the industry today is about multiplexes and megabucks. And the multiplexes are these new theaters that are being built, many of them in shopping malls, that have 8, 10, 12, 14 separate screens inside them. And the biggest one was just built by Cineplex on the Universal Studios lot, and that has 18 different theaters. Well, what that means is that you have a tremendous number of options. You can play Three Men and a Baby at three or four of your theaters if you want to. You can play it at four theaters one week. Next week, maybe you just play it at three. You also have room to play... Oh, let's see, Barbara Streisand's Nuts was playing at about three Cineplexes, didn't do well, and then was reduced to one or two screens. You have things like Barfly, Matewan, all the little odd things, Gabby, Anna, little movies that are independent movies that get a place in these multiplexes because they have to fill 14 screens, like the one right across... the boulevard from me.
So these multiplexes have increased the demand for more movies. There's more screens available to show them.
There are more screens available, which partly increases the demand for movies, but partly the increased number of movies being produced, you know, has caused the exhibitors to decide to build more multiplexes. But the multiplex is replacing, in many cases, the old Bijou or Regent from Main Street in the town. It provides a lot of flexibility. And since the movies are staggered, it usually means that if you come and you're too late to see whatever movie you wanted to see, that you usually pick something from the other movies playing rather than go home. The multiplexes have also allowed the independent producers a place to display their wares. And it doesn't really help you much if you can make a movie unless you can actually get some place to show it so that people have a chance to see it. And that is one reason that we have this tremendous, overwhelming outpouring this year of independent movies. I think there's a figure that, well, the New York Times, Vincent Canby screened or, you know, watched something like 130 movies in 2 months this year as opposed to 50 last year. That, of course, included the New York Film Festival. But it does give you some feel for the outpouring of movies. And those are mostly independent movies. Major studios have not increased their supply of movies very much.
My big gripe with the multiplexes is that they tend to be small screen theaters. Maybe,
yes,
maybe that'll change.
That's to some extent changing. The first major multiplex here in Los Angeles closed down two of its smaller screens and built two much more massive ones, about 600 or 700 seats apiece, in place of them.
I'm interested in finding out a little bit about your life in the movies. Your mother worked in the costume department for MGM when you were growing up, so I'm sure you got to see the movies a little bit. I guess movies really excited you even when you were a child. Did you decide then that you wanted to be close to them professionally when you grew up?
Oh, I wanted to be a movie star, of course. My idea was that I would write myself a role in which I could win an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay and Best Actress. I started at MGM when I was 12 years old, working in the fan mail department during the summers, stuffing envelopes with little 2x3-inch pictures of the major MGM stars, who at that time were Esther Williams, Lana Turner, and June Allison. And some of the minor ones, too.
You started writing for fan magazines. And that means in the period that this was, I guess, the 1950s, you had to go through the studios, the publicity people in the studios. Were there any unwritten rules about what aspects of a star's life you could not cover if you were writing about them?
Oh, absolutely. I will never forget, and this was at the last gasp of the studio system in the mid-50s at MGM, when one of the senior publicists said to me quite seriously, speaking of the female stars at the studio, "No MGM star drinks, smokes, or has sex, even with her own husband."
Now, did you follow that? Did you ever try to get around that and actually write the truth about someone, that they did have sex with their husband?
Very quickly, the confidential magazine came in, and the studios couldn't stick to those rules. Actually, I see my experience in the fan magazines as an earn-as-you-learn time. I really learned how to write profiles and how to do research, and got paid for doing it, and then moved on.
Were writers like you ever punished by the studios if they felt that you violated their code?
Oh, absolutely. I have been barred from several lots in my time, and let me assure you, not all for the fan magazines. I was barred from one studio lot when writing for the New York Times because the head of that studio did not like an article that I wrote, which was Hollywood's impressions of some of that studio's upcoming movies. So nobody would answer my phone calls for 3 months.
So this kind of thing still goes on?
Sure.
How did you get out of the fan magazines? Was it a difficult transition to make?
No, it was very funny. I had written I started out actually writing fiction. I had the first thing I ever published was poetry in the Atlantic Monthly. But moving to articles for the national magazines, the editor of McCall's happened to pass a newsstand where I had a 10,000-word profile of Tony Perkins in a motion picture magazine, and he had recently run a profile of Tony Perkins, so he picked up the magazine to gloat, essentially. That's what he told me later. He just picked it up because he was going to be able to read it and see how much better his profile was. Well, he felt that his profile was much inferior, called me the next day and offered me some assignments writing for McCall's.
That's an interesting story. You know, I think in a way that a lot of movie executives come and go, but that you've persisted. In other words, you've probably seen a lot of studio heads with their heads on the chopping block. Yet you keep your position at the New York Times. It gives maybe you a feeling of security that the people you're writing about don't have.
Well, there was one point where every single studio had changed its top management within the previous 18 months. That was about 5 years ago. It was quite incredible.
Can I ask you to look ahead for a moment to 1988? Do you see any big changes on the horizon in the movie industry?
There are people who feel that this overbuilding, as they term it, of theaters and the oversupply of product is going to eventually cause some sort of collision. And certainly if there's any sort of recession, the movie industry will do quite well because it's a cheap form of entertainment. But there will be some pulling back, and there will be some people who have problems. What we have seen and what we will see more of is that the small companies and the new companies that got their money during the last years of this heady stock market rise by just putting out a brochure and saying, hey, buy stock in my company, I'm making movies, that's not going to be possible anymore. And there are a lot of tottery people, tottery companies right now. Dino De Laurentiis's De Laurentiis Entertainment Group is midway to crashing onto the floor. Canon, of course, has been in trouble with the SEC and with the public for 2 years now. Whether it will survive is anyone's question.
When you were young, you wanted to be a movie star, and you once wrote that you'd never want to do that now because of how movies have changed.
Well, I would never want to do that now because I think I've matured a little bit. And what I wanted was absolute glory and adulation. What I wanted was people to adore me and to applaud my every move. I'm not sure I ever wanted to be really to be an actress, which is something different. I was a pretty crummy actress, though I did act in high school. I think now that I'd rather have the privacy that isn't possible when you are a public figure like a movie star.
One last quick question. When you're watching a movie, do the politics behind that movie, the politics that you're in the know about, ever affect your appreciation of the film?
Oh, sometimes. I think nobody could have gone into Ishtar without being aware of how much the movie had cost, of all the fights and arguments that had drifted up to public consciousness. I don't know that it would affect whether I thought the picture was good or bad, but I think it's interesting that that picture was probably given less credit than it should have been, because it wasn't a bad comedy. Just wasn't a great movie, but it wasn't a bad comedy. However, the critics could not get beyond the fact that it had cost, with marketing expenses, well over $50 million. And they were indignant that this lightweight piece of fluff, rather flawed, should have been a waste of that much money.
Well, I want to thank you very much for reviewing some of the trends of the year with us and for talking with us about your life. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
My guest has been Aljean Harmetz, and she writes about the business of movies and the personalities behind the movies for The New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with poet Robert Bly. In the 1960s, he was active against the war. More recently, he has turned to myth and fairy tales to explore what it means to be a man in our culture today. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, poet Tess Gallagher reads from her latest book, a collection of poems titled Amplitude. Her poems are very personal, ranging from growing up with an alcoholic father to life with her lover, writer Raymond Carver. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead lists his picks for the year's 10 best jazz releases. And television critic David Bianculli previews The Singing Detective, the upcoming public television miniseries. David says it could be one of the best things you'll see on TV all season. It's written by Dennis Potter, who also wrote Pennies from Heaven. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. Winter storms wreaked havoc in the Midwest today. At least 35 deaths are being blamed on the storm. Holiday air travel was stalled in Chicago and Denver. In Chicago, the morning commute was also snarled, as 4 inches of snow dropped in just 2 hours. According to Chicago's Streets Department spokeswoman Kirsten Sfari, the cleanup has not been easy.
It has been very heavy and continuous and very wet. So it keeps coming down. You finish your route, you turn around, and it's all there to do all over again.
The National Weather Service says that the storms are supposed to get much worse as they head for the East Coast. The dollar dropped to record lows today in Asia and Europe. This afternoon, after White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the U.S. believed further declines could be counterproductive, the dollar did rise above the worst levels of the day. Fitzwater declined to speculate on what caused the dollar's fall or talk about what the U.S. plans to do about the situation. Lower dollar and bond prices brought Wall Street down today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 58 points to close at 1941.81. Declines led advances 13-2 in moderate trading of 131 million shares. The Soviets are claiming that an American advisor to the Afghan guerrillas has been killed. The United States is denying the report. Today, State Department spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley said there are no U.S. military advisors in Afghanistan.
The only official presence in that country is limited to our staff of 20 people at the embassy in Kabul. They are restricted to the capital city. Our travel advisory for Afghanistan, which is still in effect, urges American citizens to avoid traveling to Afghanistan.
Afghan and Soviet troops have been engaged in a major new offensive against U.S.-backed Afghan rebels. Presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the U.S. is waiting for an accounting of the alleged death from the Soviet-backed Afghan government. In Israel today, trials for the 1,000 Palestinians in custody after 2 weeks of anti-Israeli protests continued. The Israeli authorities want to expel the 50 Palestinians from the occupied West Bank and Gaza, but so far they've not been able to do so. The American ambassador to Israel, Thomas Pickering, has registered his disapproval of the idea, and lawyers for the Palestinians say they will take advantage of the long appeals process for their clients. At least 21 Palestinian protesters were killed by Israeli troops in 2 weeks of rioting. Two U.S. warships left Barcelona, Spain ahead of schedule today after one American sailor was killed and 9 others injured in a terrorist attack over the weekend. Siegfried Buschluter reports from Madrid.
The two American ships, the USS Thorn and the Donald B. Beery, left Barcelona this morning, 1 week earlier than scheduled. They're heading for Naples, Italy, with a flag flying at half-mast as a token of mourning for 22-year-old Ronald Strong. He died from the injuries he received in Saturday's terrorist attack on a USO club in Barcelona. It was reported that the young sailor of Reedus, Pennsylvania, had been married for only a year and that his wife is expecting a baby. Spanish security authorities have growing doubts about the claims by two Catalan separatist organizations that they were behind the attack. According to eyewitness accounts, one of the two men who lobbed hand grenades into the club shouted, "Long live Lebanon!" Meanwhile, security precautions have been stepped up on the Spanish island of Mallorca, where 2 more ships of the 6th Fleet have been docked. For National Public Radio, this is Siegfried Buschluter in Madrid.
Gary Hart's campaign is getting $100,000 in federal matching funds. The Federal Election Commission today found Hart qualified for the money, based mainly on contributions given before he dropped out of the race. Hart campaign officials hope eventually to get $1 million in federal funds. The Denver, Rio Grande, and Western Railroad has agreed to buy the Southern Pacific for $1.8 billion. The Interstate Commerce Commission still has to approve, but that's expected to go quickly. I'm Michael Richards, National Public Radio News, reporting from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. With the last day of the year approaching, we've asked our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, to give us his list of the 10 best jazz releases and reissues of 1987. But it's a list he offers with certain qualifications.
Any critic's end-of-year 10 best list should be taken skeptically, mine included. No music critic hears every album that ought to be considered for the cut. To a great extent, we're all at the mercy of the record companies who either deign or decline to send us review copies. And in a good year like 1987, with so many memorable releases, so short a roster can in no way be considered definitive. 2 weeks from now, on a different day, my picks might look very different. So don't think of what follows as a list of the 10 best jazz albums of 1987, but of 10 that especially appealed to me at the time I compiled the list, a list which is in no particular order. In the jazz press, 1987 was the year Ornette Coleman was canonized. Never mind that it's been 30 years since he revolutionized jazz, improvising harmony as well as melody. In All Languages, a double set on the Caravan of Dreams label, finds alto saxophonist Coleman at the head of two groups, his reunited 1959 quartet and the spiky electric band Primetime. The acoustic stuff is superior, but either way, the working method conservatives dismissed for decades now sounds unmistakably sensible. The current avant-garde is equally healthy, as rough-hewn solo styles are incorporated into more and more complex structures. Composer and reed man Henry Threadgill's You Know the Number, a septet set for RCA Novus, and John Carter's Dance of the Love Ghosts, an octet date for Gramavision, reconcile heady structuralism and raw power. Dave Holland's free bop quintet on The Razor's Edge from ECM is a versatile small band inspired by Charles Mingus's huge-sounding combos and by free jazz's wide-open harmonic sense. Mainstream front, flugelhorn player Art Farmer's Something to Live For, a quintet date for contemporary, showcased the writing of Duke Ellington's sidekick Billy Strayhorn, and also the playing of Farmer and the increasingly impressive tenor saxophone veteran Clifford Jordan. Farmer's an eloquent player. This pretty and attentive date is one of his best. Composer and pianist Dave Frischberg has the voice of a 98-pound weakling and a sense of humor that borders on the cute. But no one else writing now so successfully blends Tin Pan Alley wordplay with a profound appreciation for jazz history. For example, the melody of Can't Take You Nowhere, the title track from his most recent Fantasy album, has its origins in a Lester Young tenor solo from the 30s. Yet Frischberg plies his trade without a hint of the tasteless showboating that sabotages some would-be jazz wits.
You knock back the schnapps, you talk back to cops, you walk in the room and conversation stops. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere. You stagger, you sag, you're half in the bag, one glass of beer and you're a total drag. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere. I buy three or four, you mooch plenty more. The check comes around and you are out the door. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere.
Equally tasteful and impressive in a different vein is singer Cassandra Wilson, a smoky-sounding contralto whose second album is Days Away on JMT. Of all the members of the New Brooklyn Avant-Garde, Wilson most deftly integrates pop and R&B strains into her harmonically adventurous jazz. Her composing would surely attract more notice if she didn't have the sexiest voice in the music. Mostly because of the compact disc boom, 1987 was a great year for jazz reissues, far too many good ones to acknowledge here. One industry insider predicts that by the end of 88, everything of value in the major labels' vaults will be back in print. Don't bet on it. Of this year's reissues, among the best were two boxed sets from the mail order house Mosaic Records of Stamford, Connecticut. The complete Blue Note recordings of Herbie Nichols celebrates the pianist and composer who died in obscurity in 1963 and who's now hailed as an innovator in the tradition of Thelonious Monk. Also on Mosaic is the complete Blue Note 45 sessions of Ike Quebec, exquisite ballads and melancholy blues by an underappreciated poet of the tenor sax. And finally, Savoy Jazz has reissued Funk Dumpling by Perry Robinson, an unjustly neglected master of the modern clarinet. This 1962 quartet date also offers an early look at the great bop pianist Kenny Barron. Looking ahead to 1988, my one wish is that saxophone colossus Sonny Rollins will finally return to making records loyal fans won't have to pretend to like. Happy New Year.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat Cadence and Jazz Times. If you'd like to get a copy of his 10 Best list, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to 10 Best, Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's 10 Best, Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. This is from Perry Robinson's Funk Dumpling. It's called Sprite's Delight. You're listening to Fresh Air. Poet Tess Gallagher once said that poems have always been her secret church, the place she feels she can hear and reach other people and herself. Her poems have that sense of confession and introspection. Gallagher's new collection, Amplitude, combines new poems with selected ones from three previous volumes. She's also written essays on poetry and a book of short stories. Gallagher lives most of the year in the small seaport town of Port Angeles, Washington, with writer Raymond Carver. Her house is not far from the one she grew up in. Gallagher's father was a longshoreman and a logger. For Gallagher, writing was an escape from the world around her.
I was raised in a household which was quite chaotic. My father was alcoholic, and so that meant that there was a great deal of uncertainty in the household. He was always threatening to leave, and So I think that I began to see language really as a way of at least letting others know my presence and what I wanted in the situation, and of also learning to think about the situation.
You weren't really able to communicate very well with your parents, right?
Not at that point. I think when I began to really seriously write poetry, I did manage to make contact with my father in a way which was very moving to me and to him, I think. I have a poem that was really one of the most satisfying poems I wrote early on that I gave to him, and it kind of did honor to him as a working man. I could read that poem for you.
Yeah, would you read that poem?
Yeah, it's entitled Black Money. his lungs heaving all day in a sulfur mist. Then dusk, the lunch pail torn from him before he reaches the house. His children, a cloud of swallows around him. At the stove in the tumbled rooms, the wife, her back the wall he fights most, and she with no weapon but silence and to keep him from the bed. In their sleep, the mill hums and turns at the edge of water. Blue smoke swells the night, and they drift from the graves they have made for each other, float out from the open-mouthed sleep of their children, past banks and businesses, the used car lots, liquor store, the swings in the park. The mill burns on, now a burst of cinders, now whistles screaming down the bay, saws jagged in half-light. Then, like a whip, the sun across the bed, windows high with mountains, and the sleepers fallen to pillows as gulls fall, tilting against their shadows on the log booms. Again the trucks shudder the wood-framed houses passing to the mill. My father snorts, splashes in the bathroom, throws open our doors to cowboy music. On the radio, hearts are cheating. Somebody is alone. There's blood in Tulsa. Out the backyard, the night shift men rattle the gravel in the alley going home. My father fits goggles to his head. From his pocket he takes anything metal, the pearl-handled jackknife, a ring of keys, and for us, black money, shoveled from the sulfur pyramids heaped in the distance like yellow gold. Coffee bottle tucked in his armpit, he swaggers past the chicken coop, a pack of cards at his breast. In a fan of light beyond him, the Quino Maru pulls out for Seattle, some black star climbing the deep globe of his eye.
You said that your father was very moved by that poem. Did that convince him that there was more worth in poetry than he might have originally thought?
Oh, I think so. He folded the poem up and he put it in his pocket and he said, I'm going to show that poem to the boys down on the docks, because by that point he was working as a longshoreman, and I suddenly had a vision of my poems going out to quite a different audience than I had imagined. I had really quite another idea of it and of him in their midst with this very special thing, this poem, which gave him another dimension.
For over a decade now, you've been involved with writer Raymond Carver. And he's a writer from a similar background in a way. You're both from the state of Washington. And I think his father also was an alcoholic. When you and Raymond Carver started being together, how long did it take you till you wrote a poem about him? What I'm thinking is it might be very easy to get self-conscious writing a poem to someone who you love, who is also a writer and can read the poem very critically.
Oh, yes. Well, it took me a long time to answer your question. And I think that element of not wanting to do it because he might be expecting it or I should write it. I mean, after all, he had dedicated about 5 books to me by the time I finally was able to write the poem. And I had worked up a certain amount of anxiety about, well, this, I'm not very reciprocal, am I?
Is this the poem Bonfire that you're talking about?
Yes.
It's a beautiful poem. I'd love for you to read it.
It was written after a period of my illness and recovery, and it had been a serious enough illness that at one point we really feared that I might have cervical cancer. Bonfire for Ray. The inflections of joy, the inflections of suffering, and strangely, sometimes the mixing of the two. It reminds me of opening the huge international butterfly book with over 2,000 species illustrated in color, and among them the giant birdwing butterfly, Ornithoptera victoriae, obtained when John McGilvery, aboard the HMS Rattlesnake, used a shotgun to bring it down somewhere in the Pacific. Other wild petals shattered by use of pronged arrows in New Guinea, and the laughable mechanical butterfly intended as a decoy, said to be very successful in capturing the flashing blue morpho. So many kinds of crying, so much raw gaiety, variegated with glittering silence. And you, my sudden bouquet, who came to me awkwardly at the head of the stairwell, outside the room that sheltered for so many nights our sleeping and loving, to weep there together. With my death all handsomely in view, all open before us as the sea at night, all tenderly wild in that calm. Safe midnight, your arms strong to hold my face into yours, while the miracle of living raked its silky rapier down our backs. The last time I kissed a man in fear, my first love went to war. But I kissed you anyway, that seal of life, letter sent and received in an instant. Once in Quebec I drank cognac in the snow, and on a dare ice-skated with my friend's violin. I'd been falling all day, diving into flesh, like a spirit half in, half out of the world. But give me a perishable, fragile beauty that belongs to someone else, and I skate like music, like the wizard of the hopeful. How many times I saved myself on behalf of that borrowed, that shuddering violin. When I handed it back, he played his bonfire of thanksgiving, played a mazurka, then a jig, then something vast and aching, as when love must go on and at the same time perish. I'm talking about memory now, that moment in which the doctor's news flushed us through with dread, and I hadn't swerved back yet into life. Even then I didn't forget you, violin who threw yourself into my arms, asking not to be broken one more time. It wasn't for music you came to me, but for daring, mine and yours. When they have to, they will write in the book of welcome, two darings, two darlings.
Do you think that writing poetry makes life larger than life?
I think that it certainly does for me. And yet it also helps us honor those aspects of life which seem quite ordinary. And I try not to lose the dimension of the beauty of ordinariness also when I talk about those kinds of subjects in my poems.
Poet Tess Gallagher spoke to us from NPR station WCNY in Syracuse, New York. Her new book of poems, Amplitude, is published by Grey Wolf Press. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we're covering the fall of the dollar. It reached a new record post-war low against the Japanese yen. We'll also hear from one economist, Nobel laureate James Tobin, who says that the government and all Western governments should let the dollar fall as low as it must until the deficit, trade deficit, is helped by it. We'll also have a report from Bill Buesenberg in London about the problems facing the Channel.
I give up. What's the Channel?
The Channel is how they say channel tunnel in England and also in France. It's that one of the most talked about engineering projects in modern history, a tunnel that would connect Britain to France underneath the English Channel.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our television critic David Bianculli has a review of The Singing Detective. It's a new BBC miniseries that will start this weekend on many public television stations. The series was first offered to Masterpiece Theatre and the Arts and Entertainment Network, but they didn't go for it.
Masterpiece Theatre made a huge mistake by turning down The Singing Detective. It's the closest thing to a real masterpiece I've seen on TV in my 12 years as a critic. If your local PBS station is showing it this week, you've got to see it. You won't regret it and you won't forget it. The Singing Detective stars Michael Gambon as an author named Philip Marlowe, Marlowe without an E, that is, who, naturally, writes detective novels. As The Singing Detective begins, Marlowe is hospitalized with a rare skin disease, and he's stuck in a crowded ward with a bunch of loonies and losers. He tries to keep from going crazy himself by mentally rewriting one of his early books into a screenplay. Which book? A book called The Singing Detective. And his wife, Nicola, played by Janet Sussman, thinks he's wasting his time.
Use your talent, Philip.
Bugger that.
Write about real things in a realistic way. Real people, real joys, real pains. Not these silly detective stories. Something more relevant.
Solutions.
What?
All solutions and no clues. That's what the dumbheads want. I'd rather it was the other way around. All clues, no solutions. That's the way things really are.
That's a nice description of this miniseries, too, which has at least five stories running at the same time. It takes about an hour to get them all up to speed. But boy, from then on, the singing detective is fantastic. The medication they give to Marlowe makes him hallucinate, and his mind wanders back to his childhood, back through his singing detective novel, and even plagues him while he deals with the hospital's psychiatrist and nurses. And Marlowe's not the only mentally unstable character. Nicola's secret lover, who's scheming to steal the rights to Marlowe's story, is so paranoid that he begins to fear that he's only a figment of Marlowe's imagination. And you know what? He may be right.
I have this awful dash. He stops himself, comma, and all but shudders. Full stop.
Darling, dash question mark.
I have this awful...
Darling.
Premonition.
Dennis Potter, who wrote this miniseries, is himself a victim of the skin disease he gives to Marlowe, and he brings a gripping realism to his scenes in the ward, even when they lapse into fantasy or song, which they do a lot. When an attractive nurse is rubbing lotion on his chafed thighs, Marlowe makes a mental list of boring things as he fights a losing battle to keep from getting aroused. And when she says something that sets him off, the music starts and the nurse suddenly becomes a glamorous torch singer.
Think, really boring. A well-smelled voice choir, everything in punch, huh? Oh.
Poor thing.
Australian barman, ecologist, semiologist. Think.
I'm sorry, but I shall have to lift your penis now to grease round it.
My mama done told me when I was in pigtails.
There's no way to describe the singing detective properly in 25 words or less. All I can say is that Potter, who wrote the outstanding miniseries version of Pennies from Heaven, the one that was infinitely superior to the Americanized Steve Martin movie, has outdone himself and outdone everybody else as well. The cast is superb, and the singing detective should do for Michael Gambon what the original Pennies from Heaven did for Bob Hoskins and launch a major new star. Make plans to watch The Singing Detective, and if you can, tape it. You'll want to see it again and again, and each viewing will reveal new treasures. The beauty of The Singing Detective is much, much more than skin deep.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with veteran actor Ned Beatty. He spent 15 years in the theater before trying his hand at movies and landing a role in the film Deliverance. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward will profile the Chantels, the 50s girl group that was the forerunner of the Shirelles and the Ronettes. And we'll hear from language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg, so I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton and Janine Colgren-Miller. Our engineer is Orji Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air.
Tomorrow, I'll speak with veteran actor Ned Beatty. He spent 15 years in the theater before trying his hand at movies and landing a role in the film Deliverance. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward will profile the Chantels, the 50s girl group that was the forerunner of the Shirelles and the Ronettes. And we'll hear from language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg, so I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton and Janine Colgren-Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.